I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is songwriter and poet Stephen Merritt. He's joined in conversation by San Francisco Chronicle pop music critic Ideen Vaziri. And now join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Stephen Merritt and Ideen Vaziri.
I think Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, said it best in his endorsement for the book. When I have no Scrabble move, I really cannot bear it. From ah to za, help has arrived. Why, thank you, Stephen Merritt. This book is a one-of-a-kind celebration of all the two-letter words allowed in Scrabble, beautifully illustrated by the wonderful Roz Chast. As I'm sure you all know, Stephen Merritt is the lead singer and songwriter for the Magnetic Fields and has also created and played principal roles in The Sixths, The Gothic Archies, and Future Bible Heroes. He's collaborated on pieces for musical theater, recorded and released soundtracks to films, and wrote the music and lyrics for the off-Broadway adaptation of Neil Gaiman's Coraline. Locally, you may have also seen him at the Castro Theater with the San Francisco International Film Festival. A few years ago, he produced a score for the silent film 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and just this past April conducted the audience in creating a score for another short film. So what can't he do? It should not surprise us, then, that he's also written this wonderful little book of clever four-line rhyming poems for each of the two-letter words you can play in Scrabble. He's joined tonight in conversation by Ideen Vaziri, pop music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. So please join me in welcoming Stephen Merritt and Ideen Vaziri.
Hi there.
You look just like that guy backstage.
I know. We're brothers. Do your friends even attempt to play Scrabble with you anymore? Do they just know they're going to lose?
Actually, I'm not necessarily very good at Scrabble. I just know all the two-letter words. But before I knew all the two-letter words, I was terrible at Scrabble, which is why you should carefully study the two-letter words, or you'll be just as mediocre a Scrabble player as I am.
So this is a sure way to get a low score in any game.
Well, I like to think that the book is a good way to get up to the baseline that you need to have to play Scrabble at all, basically.
Right.
Because before I started writing the book, I was really basically a worthless Scrabble player, and now I'm mediocre.
I'm really curious why you felt, out of all the things that you've come across in your life, you felt so compelled to writing this as your first book. Were you feeling that?
It was really kind of horrible to be a totally worthless Scrabble player.
You were that affected, is
yeah.
What I'm asking, yeah.
Everyone I know is a pretty good Scrabble player, and I was the only bad one, so now I'm up there with everyone I know. I should explain that everyone I know is a famous writer, so it's a little... my experience may be a little skewed.
Now, your goal was to use these... you were going to memorize them, so anytime you were stuck and looking at letters, you could just kind of, in your head, recite this. But earlier you were telling me that there's a problem with that, because when you go to recite these poems from memory, what happens?
Well, so here we have an actual poem from the actual book. an androgyne from Anchorage, annoyed an anthropologist, and suffered injuries that sent him to the gynecologist. So I do remember that, you know, without looking at it, I guess. I look at it to make sure. But with some of them, I remember the first version, not the published version, because that's the one I memorized and had in my head for a year before some copy editor got it into his or her head to change my work. First I had a complete set of mnemonic devices that helped me remember the 101 Scrabble two-letter words. Now I have a published set that helps you remember the two-letter words. I remember the two-letter words because I wrote a book about it, but I don't remember the poems because they have been changing. You will remember the poems because you won't know about the other poems, but I can't reliably produce the right poem on cue. So I should say about Anne, this particular one, a lot of the two-letter words are hard to remember because they're two-letter words, like pay, P-E, the 17th letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's, you know, it could be K, K-E, and only be slightly different. And how do you remember which is which when there's only two letters to cue you? And it just seems arbitrary. So there I am in sixth grade, and I'm doing a quiz in my writing class. Well, you know, my writing class. I'm in sixth grade. In class, I'm in sixth grade. And it was about social studies or something. And I know the material perfectly well, but I suddenly couldn't quite remember what is the indefinite article in the English language beginning with A that comes before a vowel. The second letter must be a consonant. What are the choices? Ab, ack, ad, af, ag, ah, aj, ack, al, am, an, ap, ack, ar, as, z, at, av, au, ags, I've just run out of letters. None of them sounded right. None of them sounded familiar. And I sat there for minutes and minutes trying to remember, and unable to. And so I carefully used a consonant at the beginning of each of the nouns that I might need an indefinite article for till the end of the test, because I did the entire test without being able to remember "an." So this is a central formative experience of my two-letter words in my childhood.
That's why you wrote this book. That's the real
reason. So I could remember all the two-letter words.
Yes. Yes. Never
Even
again.
Even this one.
So if I pull this, if we're playing a game and I pull this book out and start flipping through it, that's cheating. You can't do that. You have to memorize these.
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, you can't.
If you take a trip to the bathroom before you go and you read through the book on the toilet, because that's what you have in the little toilet bookshelf. You don't read in the bathroom? What do you do in the bathroom? All I do in the bathroom is read. I don't know what other people do. I think it's not cheating at all if you just want to read a book. Whatever book.
Yeah. You made them easy enough to memorize. Let's talk about the illustrations for a minute. They're beautiful. You got Roz Chass to do it. You met her and How did you pitch this idea?
So, my editor at Norton said, I think it's time that we looked for an illustrator. And I said, well, I know a number of talented illustrators, some of whom are here tonight, and the thing is, I just got this fan letter 2 or 3 days ago from Roz Chast, who said, if you ever want to work together or anything on whatever, look me up.
Is writing a book, even this book, less stressful than making an album? Or?
Oh, it's infinitely less stressful than making an album. Making an album, you have to talk to other people and ask them again and again to play this simple thing that you've written, and they just want to interpret it. Unbearable. But that nothing of the kind happens when you're writing poetry.
Right.
And I didn't actually interrelate with Roz in any particular way during writing the book, because I basically wrote the book and handed it to her. But the only thing that I had to interact with her about was that I got the illustrations, and I was horrified to see that she had misspelled artisanal. But that was my only comment on her 101 illustrations.
So she got all 101 right when you saw them. They're just
they were fantastic.
That's great.
Except that on the box of Fay, artisanal was misspelled in a common way.
The poems are about various subjects. Sometimes within the same poem, a lot of them are about vampire dogs, though. Where?
No, that's a common misunderstanding. We mustn't mention that. Just so that we don't.
Oh, that puppy sure is cute. Please, can we take him home?
The victims of the vampire dog would fill a hefty tome.
Okay, now we can talk about vampire dogs.
When I memorize that, do I have to memorize it in that voice?
Yeah, that's half the fun.
That's how it goes.
Ooh.
Nice. Is that Irving? Is Irving carrying on his...
I didn't actually give Roz any pictures of Irving, but it looks reasonably like Irving, my former Chihuahua. I mean, he remains a Chihuahua, but he's... Well, not really. He's been cremated. I guess a cremated Chihuahua is in no way a Chihuahua.
Irving, for those who don't know, was more than just a Chihuahua. He was your constant companion. He was named after Irving Berlin, and he was always kind of attached to you and under your hat or just on you for how many years? 13? 14?
He died at 14, and I
14,
had him all his life.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't always attached to me. I did go on tour without him. Several times. I only went on tour with him once. It became a consensus that I was not going to bring him on tour again. I think the last straw was when we played in Cambridge downstairs at the Middle East, and the green room was immediately off the stage, and Irving was in the green room, and he heard me singing, and he heard Claudia singing, and either way, he would start, anytime anyone was singing, he would start howling, because he knew we were there, and why didn't we come and pick him up and put him in our shirts? So the entire audience could hear him howling at least as well as they could hear us singing.
Aye.
What all in favor say is aye, while those again say nay. But those in thrall to vampire dog say, I hear and obey.
Were these written in a similar environment?
They were probably mostly written either in my bedroom with Irving actually sitting in my sweater or something, or across the street in the nearest gay bar.
Right.
Yeah, pretty similar environment, too.
Now, you tend to, you know, a few years ago you went through the, with the distortion, you went through the kind of the Jesus and Mary Chain phase, and then immediately after that you went through your Judy Collins phase.
Mm-hmm.
And have you already moved on from this? Have you already lost interest in two-letter words in your head? Are you somewhere else? Or how long do those phases typically last with you?
Well, as long as the project. I try not to repeat myself too much.
Right. But as far as your interest level in something, how long is it before you move on to the next thing?
Well, I try to exhaust my interest level with the project. I am still playing Words with Friends, and in fact now I'm playing Words with Friends with 15 people instead of 7 people. But at the end of my book tour, I'm going to whittle that down a little bit and start reading crosswords again. I mean, doing crossword puzzles again. Because I swore them off for the duration of this, of writing this book and promoting it. Because I didn't want to think in terms of crosswords. I wanted to just dedicate half of my brain to the two-letter words. And that you never see two-letter words in a crossword puzzle except on Thursdays. The New York Times crossword gets kind of tricky, and sometimes they have funny shapes or even one-letter words. But the rest of the week, there's no two-letter words.
Have you been working on music at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right now I'm working on a mini musical that will be part of a This American Life episode.
Nice. Mike. My main concern is, as a fan, is always that you write so many songs about love and relationships that at some point you're just going to figure it all out and you're not going to have anything else to write about. You close?
Oh, I reached that point decades ago. Bye. The bi orientation is the happiest of all. If only they could bottle it and sell it at the mall.
Did you set any of these to music? Did you try?
Okay. So I am holding a ukulele.
Yes. I noticed.
So I will now demonstrate why it doesn't work. Why I chose to express myself through poetry instead of song. And pahoey hoey Ursus, there are two kinds of lava, A'a and Pahoehoe. A'a is more jagged, and Pahoehoe, flowy. As a poem, it's much more memorable.
I'm not sure you made your point there.
You're listening to songwriter and poet Stephen Merritt, whose new book is 101 Two-Letter Words. He's joined in conversation by Adine Vazeri on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
That makes me think, when you, the first time you were interested in music, you were, what, 5 years old, and you heard the song Little White Duck, and you thought it could be done better. So that kind of launched your music career, right? It was at that point where you decided that you were going to do it.
That's funny. It's never been put that way to me. I always thought of it as just, Little White Duck was the first song I ever hated. But you're right. Little White Duck maybe forced me into a musical career from an early age through the sheer intense savagery of its inanity. Yes. I get back at Pete Seeger in my book, but I won't read that one. Duh. Duh means of or from. In names like Cruella de Vil. It's fun to use in drag name games, to wit, Ova de Hill.
This one frustrated you because the two-letter words in the French language, like some of them count in Scrabble and some don't, right?
Right. You can't play le, but you can play ut, the archaic version of the seventh letter, the seventh scale degree of solfège system. The former French version of t. T.I., as made famous by Rodgers and Hammerstein with tea, a drink with jam and bread, which as a child I thought was a drink with jam and bread, German bread. I didn't know. I thought they were Austrians. They said German in a German accent. Oops.
Have you written letters to the people who write the rules for Scrabble, raising these objections? Have you
No one
this
admits
formally?
To writing to it's a secret committee. It's kind of like the people who make the decisions about children's toys in general. It's really clear that Light Bright was taken off the market because it should be called imminent choking death. Nevertheless, for the company to admit that would be as bad as them changing the name to imminent choking death and then marketing it some more. So because of that, there isn't a sort of public spokesperson for the Scrabble decision-making committee. X. Sometimes one feels frisky and one wants to sex one's ex. Best to try it first with a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Was this one written from personal experience?
Oh, no.
No.
I have no idea about these things. I just sit in my bathroom reading. He, Pa's a he, and Ma's a she, and Trevor is a tranny. We're not sure what to call him now. We used to call him Granny. Now, I should mention that I wrote this a year and a half ago when the word tranny was completely uncontroversial in every way, and everyone was calling him or herself a tranny, willy-nilly. But now the wagons have circled around tranny, and I imagine that my book will be burned when I get to Seattle tomorrow.
I've always been curious how you would fill out a personal ad, especially after reading this book.
So there's an Allen Ginsberg poem, which is an answer to that. It's in the form of a personal ad, and it can also be performed as a song, but not by me, because I don't know it. But I was invited to do an Allen Ginsberg poem for some, I think it was some Hal Willner thing or something, and that was the one I picked. But then the production company somehow went belly up because I guess it hadn't financed the project first. But anyway, the poem was tantamount to, you know, famous poet, middle-aged, Jewish, Columbia-educated, East Village resident, seeks young, pre-apic, not too opinionated assistant / companion for cohabitation and maybe more, and went on from there. So I have no idea how I would fill out a personal ad. I would never ever make one. Although there is one in the book under ad, and that one has changed. I think the current version is, place an ad today and tell the world you've love to give. Tomorrow, too, the world has all the memory of a sieve. But I think the first version was, Yoko placed an ad, and now we all have peace on earth. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Shows what advertising's worth, or something. I don't remember, but it was pro-advertising and violently pro-Yoko. But I think the copy editors didn't understand that I wasn't joking.
Do you find that as you get older, you've grown more tolerant of other people? Because not saying that you were not tolerant of people a few years ago, but a little bit, maybe.
If I weren't tolerant of other people, there wouldn't be almost 7 billion of them. People think that I hate children, for example, but as long as they're not eating or speaking, I have no problem with children.
I think there was a quote in an article once where you said you hate children.
It's a phobia. It's not a dislike. Okay. I have no problem. Speaking of children, Ma gets blamed for everything, like every other Ma. Pa, meanwhile, is on a pub crawl, skanking to the ska. if you can't read it, Roz has Pa saying, "This is all her fault."
That reminds me. You met your dad for the first time in ever? Last year? 2 years ago?
This year. This year, I met my father for the first time then the second time. The occasion being that he was in a documentary about Doc Pomus, who was a famous songwriter of the 50s and 60s and even 70s. He wrote or co-wrote Why Do Fools Fall in Love and This Magic Moment. Save the Last Dance for Me and other songs. And he was good friends with my father. So my father thought it would be a sweet way of meeting me for the first time to sort of say, "Oh, hi, here, let's sit down and watch this movie in which I appear as a talking head." And in fact, it was. It was a lovely documentary. I highly recommend it. I don't know how other people go about meeting their parents, but for me, that was completely normal.
Right. Your father was Scott Fagan, a folk singer who you never... He was just gone as you were growing up. You never saw him until, like you said, earlier this year. And your relationship now, did you harbor any anger towards him, or were you resentful at all, or was it just you sat down?
No, I didn't. I hadn't met him in the first place. I couldn't.
Yeah, he just indifferent to the whole thing.
Sure, I didn't really have much of an emotional response because I'd never met him. Let's move on.
Yes.
"Ow. Ow," says Pa, as Ma jumps up and down upon his head. "Take one deep breath and count to ow. Is it something I said?"
That's a good one.
Yeah, I included this one because I wanted to have the whole Ma and Pa saga, but also really because it's one of my preferred Roz Chast illustrations. My drag name is Violencia Domestica, and I'm particularly fond of this picture. "Ox. Trixie was the ox princess. She ruled the happy oxen until a rival dosed her with a nasty neurotoxin." It helps to know that oxen are actually castrated bulls. I always thought they were a different species, like the yak, but no. They're cows that have a little piece missing. So Trixie's gender is in question and in flux.
There's a lot of violence in this book, isn't there?
Only if you consider the way Americans treat animals to be. Well, we don't know that Trixie is an American. She might not be American.
As you said, while you were writing this book, you moved from L.A. to New York, upstate New York. Why did you move, and what's it like? Why would anyone leave L.A.?
Because it's too far from New York City. I was sitting in my little tiny studio apartment in New York City once, and I thought, where's that book? And I realized that I hadn't been home to L.A. in 6 months. And I hadn't even had time to think about going home to L.A., where almost all my books were and all my records. So I realized that the bicoastal scene wasn't working out for me. And it would be better to have a much shorter commute. So I took my studio and all my books and stuff and moved it to Hudson, New York, which is 2 hours from New York City by train. And now I'm much happier. It was a really great decision. I've never regretted it for a moment.
When you move from city to city, how do you find those bars that you like to hang out in with the right volume and the right crowd? And
That's simple. I go to all the gay bars in the city and figure out which ones I like. Which is how I met Pa. Pa paws Paolo from Paducah sometimes in the loo. Ma paws with Neil and I, she rescued from the zoo. I might want to explain that I is a three-toed sloth. It appears earlier in the book, of course. And say, I, a threatened three-toed sloth found only in Brazil. It munches on leaves and sleeps in trees. I hope it always will. But it may not, because it's a threatened three-toed sloth. And people keep stealing it from zoos because it's so much fun to sleep. Up from an unhallowed grave, the vampire dog arises. Now Chihuahua, now Great Dane, a master of disguises. Us is me and Gus, driving our bus across the land. When we die, just bury us together, hand in hand.
Now that one's almost sweet.
Right.
Yeah.
So
did you have? Was that?
But it's the illustration that makes it sweet, kind of, because us, the us could have looked like anyone. Roz has made it a pair of gay men, but it doesn't say that it's a pair of gay men. And Gus is a dual gender name because it can be short for Augustus or Augusta, and also. There's Gussie. So it's usually male, but it's often, there's a lot of female Gusses too. So it could have been a lesbian pair or a heterosexual pair. Gus could have been an I.
Did you find the tone change once you paired them with the drawings? Did it change the whole feel of the book?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wrote B-E, be yourself, all thinkers say. How odd they think alike. Be yourself, says Lao Tzu. Be yourself, says Wilhelm Reich. But Roz took it a step further by illustrating it with a pair of ugly American tourists with his and hers matching shirts. His says, be yourself. And hers says, I'm with stupid. She really upstaged me on that one. So one more poem. Za. So Ma and Pa pick at their za with faces grim and stony. Ma munches on the crunchy crust, and Pa the pepperoni.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features songwriter and poet Stephen Merritt, whose new book is 101 Two-Letter Words. He's joined in conversation by Ideen Vaziri. Bina is also available as a podcast. and you can find it at kalw.org.
What are some other things that you've considered writing books about? Do you have a list of ideas going?
I definitely have a list of ideas going. But I would only tell you about the ones I was no longer interested in.
Oh, yeah. What are your rejects?
Well, I am not interested in writing the sequel, 1,083 three-letter words. except that there sure are a lot of really interesting three-letter words, many of which I just can't remember. Of those 1,083, I can easily remember maybe 400 of them, and then, oh boy, several of them at least have no vowels in them. So good luck pronouncing them or something. So why don't I do a song, since I'm holding a ukulele? But I don't have any lyric sheet, so I can only do songs that I happen to remember the lyrics for, which basically means very short songs which are 15 years old or more. Like, buy more stock in roses, millionaires will always woo. Don't be shocked if roses make a millionaire of you. Thank you. I like to use that song as an illustration of why it wouldn't have worked for me to write 101 songs about the two-letter words, because it's a 15-second long song.
You got all the words right and everything. That's great.
Yes. Yeah. That's probably the only song I have ever written for which I always get all the words right.
Good. Do you want to play another song, or...?
I wish I had an orchestra behind me to show you how I feel. Well, the orchestra remains imaginary, but this little ukulele is real. I wish I had an orchestra behind me. When you lose faith, an orchestra gives proof. Well, an orchestra can tell you pretty stories, but this little ukulele tells the truth. Thank you.
I was thinking about how you once said that you would love Dolly Parton to cover one of your songs, and I'd love to hear her do that one. That would be amazing. Which one of your albums would you buy as a fan, just as a music fan, if you were in a record store flipping through...
Through Dolly Parton albums, which one would I buy?
Through the magnetic field
definitely
section.
The Grass is Blue.
Or the...
The Grass is Blue. It's a great album.
Well, Dolly, yeah.
Yeah.
What about out of all the albums you've made?
I always tell people to buy 69 Love Songs because it's the one I make the most on. But my favorite is The Charm on the Highway Strip. I don't have favorite things much, but basically I like it for the cover. I designed it. It's the kind of record cover I like, and also I like the idea of the album and how it came out. So the Charm on the Highway Strip for me is the record I have the least problem with.
69 Love Songs is a wonderful album. You really set yourself up, though, because it's the one that people are always going to compare anything you do. They're going to hold it up against that one. And you knew that going in because you set out to make a classic album. Right?
It was... I knew that it was going to be a Rumours, after which I was going to have to make a Tusk.
And you always preferred Tusk to Rumours, as I recall.
I think Tusk, Tusk is a great album, yeah. I don't apply that to the White Album versus Sgt. Pepper's, that kind of thing, but or Smiley Smile after Pet Sounds. I don't regard it as a principle. I just think that Tusk is an album that I have listened to thousands of times, and it reveals something new every time, as long as I don't listen to it too much, because I have had the experience of thinking that I should put a record on. Why not put on Tusk? And then I realized I already have put a record on, and it is Tusk, and it's playing, and I just think it's playing in my head, but it's actually playing. And I've had that experience not once, but twice.
Have you seen a doctor about that?
Well, it's my business to have music playing in my head, so... No, I guess if I saw a doctor about it, the doctor would give me something that would stop the music playing in my head, and suddenly I wouldn't have music playing in my head. And then I'd have to write poetry.
Which is okay, right?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think your next musical project is going to be like? What have you been listening to lately that's kind of leading you in a certain direction?
Weirdly, what I have been listening to musically is an audiobook of a novel. The Neil Gaiman novel, The Truth is a Cave in the Black Mountains, which I guess was actually written as a visual collaboration, but I bought the audiobook and listened to it in my car, and I've been listening to it a number of times because I really like the way the string arrangements underscore the whole story, and I want to use that in the piece I'm doing with This American Life. I'm trying to take that bleak mountainous kind of mood and do it in a way that I can translate into something I do in my studio, played largely by me on this. But the thing is, it's not meant to be listened to as music, because it's a novel.
You did 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea at the Castro. You did the live score for that. Is that something you'd want to do again?
But I wouldn't want to do quite what I did at the Castro. For 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, I musicalized the score. I made the silent movie into a musical, which is something that one could theoretically do and do well in a modern recording studio locked to time code on an actual movie, but that's not what I was doing. I was doing it live, so it was inherently unrealizable. We couldn't possibly stay in sync with the actors. I should explain that I can read lips pretty well because I can't hear very well, so I read the actors' lines from their lips and could pretty easily tell what they were saying. like, look, a deep sea diver. Look, a shark. And there's a shark. It's not that hard. But it's kind of hard when your goal is to musicalize it and have it rhyme. And that was what I tried to do for the Castro. So it took me many months to even get to the Shags-like place of... There's kind of an idea, but the idea is so actually difficult to realize that it falls apart in every way with every second. And I thought that aesthetic was pretty clear. A big chunk of the audience did not understand that aesthetic at all. And they just thought that we were making fun of the film. Like Frank Zappa kind of level of zaniness. But we were actually trying to do it. Seriously trying to be in sync with the actors and trying to make a musical. So it was an unbelievable amount of work for one night only, which greatly alienated a big chunk of the audience, although I think it was probably more the silent movie purist chunk of the audience, and befuddled people.
I can't believe there was confusion about something that you did.
Yes. Maybe I'll do another song.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of confusion about my intentions. Isn't the same on radio. It's all about the makeup and the dancing and the oh, pretty girl is like a violent crime. If you do it wrong, you could do time. But if you do it right, it is sublime. I'm so in love with you, girl. It's like I'm on the moon. I can't really breathe, but I feel lighter. A melody is like a pretty girl. Who cares if it's the dumbest in the world? It's all about the way that it unfurls. A pretty girl is like a pretty girl. Excuse me.
Your ukulele is still out. Would you please play your girlfriend's face?
If I can get the lyrics wrong, sure.
Yes, please.
I'll try it. So I've taken a contract out on you. I have hired a hitman to do what they do. He will do his best to do his worst. After he's messed up your girlfriend first, I said he'll do his worst to your girlfriend first. Cause I've hired a fixer for her too. stealing my lover and making me blue. They'll have to hose off your trysting place after he blows off your girlfriend's face. I want the whole bloody place red with your girlfriend's face. Cause I've taken a contract out on y'all for making me feel infinitely small. In the evenings I've devised your death, being buried alive on crystal meth. Baby, I give you death. Bye, 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 crystal meth. Baby, I give you death. Bye, 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 crystal meth. Baby, I give you death. Bye, 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 crystal meth. Baby, I give you death. Bye, bye, crystal meth. Baby, I give you death. Bye, 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 crystal meth. Baby, I give you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was songwriter and poet Stephen Merritt, whose new book is 101 Two-Letter Words. He was joined in conversation by Ideen Vaziri. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature actor, screenwriter, and author Jason Siegel. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.